it's more fun this way.
No problem.
You know, it's kind of ironic when the sun actually comes out and then we complain.
Good afternoon. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Finance Order. It's about 11:33 and Friday, January 26, 2018. Present today are Representative Ortiz, Representative Pruitt, Representative Kawasaki, Representative Wilson, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Tilton, and Co-Chair Seaton. Representative Thompson, Guerra, and Ortiz are excused today. Before we start, I'll remind everybody about their cell phones. And today we will hear department budget overviews from the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs and Health and Social Services. We will also introduce the technically corrected work drafts of the operating budget, HB 286, and the mental health budget, HB 285. So we will start with Commissioner. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself? And since there are two male voices, if they're answering questions, just say your name again first after we've introduced.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Laurie Hummel. I am Alaska's Adjutant General and the Commissioner of the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs. And we are headquartered at the National Guard Readiness Center on Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairs and members of the committee. My name is Bob Dole. I am Deputy Commissioner of the State of Alaska Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Brian Duffy. I currently serve as the Administrative Services Director for the Department of Military and Veterans Affairs at Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson near Anchorage, Alaska. Thank you.
And before we proceed, I want to recognize Representative Guttenberg who joined us.
Thank you.
And Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So first, a quick reminder on DMVA's mission, that it's centered around four key functions. First, we provide uniformed members of the Alaska Organized Militia, and that consists of the Alaska Air National Guard, the Alaska Army National Guard, the Alaska State Defense Force, and the Alaska Naval Militia, who come together to support state mission requirements, and the Army and the Air Guard also have federal mission requirements for the state. Additionally, we provide Homeland Security and Emergency Management programs and services, a military-style education program for at-risk youth, which of course is known as the Alaska Military Youth Academy, which is one of the National Guard Youth Challenge programs around the country, and services to our state's veteran population. A quick reminder on DMVA's organizational structure and our supporting elements. You'll see two additional organizations that are beyond our divisions. First on the left, at the bottom of the dashed arrow, is the United States Property and Fiscal Office. And that serves as the chief of the National Guard Bureau's senior representative to the state of Alaska. And he is accountable for all of the federal funds and the property in the possession of the National Guard within the state. United States Property and Fiscal Officers ensure that all federal funds are obligated and expended in conformance with applicable guidelines. And he doesn't work for me. He works directly for the Chief of National Guard Bureau. So he is directly accounting to make sure that we are doing what we need to do as far as spending our federal dollars wisely and legally. And at the bottom of the dash arrow to the right is the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, which is only administratively aligned with the DMVA. Our general funding level remains not really a slice of the pie, but a crumb of a sliver of a slice of the pie. We are 0.36% of the state's total budget. Yet over the last 3 years, our combined team worked to bring more than 42 times that amount in federal funding into the state, a figure which grew significantly over the past 3 years despite a downward turn in general funds. And you can see that we've noted at the bottom that between state FYs 15 and 17, we consumed 14% less UGF, but yet with that money, we garnered 43% more federal funding. So our motto is to find and spend the other guy's money.
Mr. Chairman, picking up Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, on our next slide, it shows the funding history for all fund sources for the department, the Alaska Aerospace Corporation and the Alaska National Guard Retirement Benefit Appropriation. The DMVA's budget showed a nominal 4% growth over this period, the Alaska National Guard Retirement Benefit funding is no longer reflected in DMVA's line, and we would request queries on the Alaska Aerospace Corporation be directed their way. This slide shows DMVA's funding history by line item. As you can see, the majority of our funds support personal services costs and the programs and services we execute, with nominal funding for travel, commodities, capital outlays, and those associated with grants and benefits. This slide also shows the reductions to the Alaska Aerospace Receipt Authority reflected in the previous slide. Now, our next slide takes a slightly different look at our GF funding history, and I'll take a minute to orient you. The blue sections are our normal GF lines. The red represents funds which historically were passed through from DEED to support our Alaska Military Youth Academy operations, and these were incorporated into our GF line in fiscal year 15, so blue plus red turns to all blue in FY15. The green sections represent GF formerly associated with the Alaska Aerospace Corporation, again, all removed in FY15, and the yellow represents an inflationary adjustment based on the 2017 Consumer Price Index. So when you take the sum of the red, blue, and yellow back in FY07 and adjust the slide in terms of FY17 constant year dollars, and you compare it against our budget proposal on FY19, what you see is about a 15% overall reduction in that 12-year period. Now, if you look at our GF funding profile a different way, what appears to be a significant jump in funding over time is more easily explained. That upward spike to the DMVA appropriation is that transfer of the former DEED funds we'd previously tracked as interagency receipts. Additionally, what you see following that is a moderate increase based on our proposed FY19 increments associated with the expansion of the Alaska State Defense Force, a new special assistant position designed to help protect and grow DOD investment in the state, and support requirements associated with the gain of the C-17 strategic airlift mission at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson. And again, this slide outlines the legislature's previous elimination of GF support to the Alaska Aerospace Corporation. Our approach to this year's operating budget can best be binned in three broad categories. Looking first at areas where we could further reduce, we recognize Federal Receipt Authority and our Army National Guard facilities maintenance component exceeded the need over the past few fiscal years, so we reduced that amount by $1 million this budget year to better match historical actuals. And there's no program change in this area. Again, we're simply adjusting the books to better align with historical spend. Additionally, in concert with key external stakeholders, such as the National Guard Bureau and the Alaska District of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, we've undertaken an aggressive plan to divest more than 60 Alaska Army National Guard former scout armories. The termination of the recruiting federal scout waiver, the elimination of the 207th Infantry Group Scout, and other factors challenged our Army National Guard's ability to recruit in many rural locations that were once operational. Additionally, participation in the Army National Guard in these areas also diminished to the point where many former scout armories, again sometimes referred to as village readiness centers, no longer fulfilled a federal requirement. Initial estimated annual savings is $20,000 per property per year, covering costs such as utilities, maintenance, land fees, et cetera. And with 8 locations already complete, a dozen or so currently underway, and the remainder projected for execution over the next 4 years, And it's important to note that the benefactors noted in the completed section of this slide aren't necessarily representative of what the final disposition will be for those remaining to be divested. Each facility has its own attributes and ownership details. Some federally owned, some state, some municipal, some tribal, some privately owned, et cetera. And similarly, the land that they sit on has the same type of ownership categories. As such, each will follow its own path, depending on the relevant statutes and regulations. Finally, we retain responsibility to ensure facilities and properties are free of environmental hazard, another key element to the sequence in which these properties can be actioned.
Thank you. Before we go further, Co-Chair Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I didn't see Nome on this list.
Second, sir.
I didn't see Nome on this list.
Nome should be in, through the chair, Representative Foster, Nome should be in the retained category. That's an error on the slide. We'll fix that.
Thank you.
Eliminated Nome.
Apologize for the error, sir. We'll fix the slide.
We've looked at this a million times.
So moving on, this slide shows the typical interior of these facilities, most of which have been vacant for several years, with varying degrees of utility connections remaining in place. Now, coming back to our next reduction action, effective October 1st, 2017, the amount of state administrative agency grant with the U.S. federal government was increased to cover 100% of our Veterans Services Program Manager 2's salary and benefits, as well as other non-personal services costs. So given the opportunity, our intent would be to reroll those general funds to bring on additional contracted staff to provide services to our continuously growing veteran population, now exceeding 70,000. And finally, with great focus on recruitment and hiring actions and proactive management steps, we're reducing overtime expenditures in our Alaska Military Youth Academy, a program which continues to exceed expectations, having graduated the highest number of cadets in the program's history this past August. Moving over to the maintain category, with respect to the four major mission areas that General Hummel described earlier, baseline funding is generally maintained at current levels. However, we are taking action to do some cleanup work this cycle by standing down our National Guard Military Headquarters component and moving it under the Office of the Commissioner. This component only held two positions, that of our two Assistant Adjutants General for Air and Army, with nothing else. And combining them under the Office of the Commissioner simplifies our budget and simply makes good mission sense.
This is Deputy Commissioner Bob Dole picking up the testimony at this point and hopefully making a clear record transition. Before
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just on the Military Youth Academy, I see the making sure you're going to minimize unnecessary overtime expenditures. Is there capacity at the Military and Youth Academy to take in more students that would benefit Alaskans in a way that would, well, I mean, we know what the Military Youth Academy does. Is it sort of at capacity?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, it is at capacity for our current staffing levels, and so we would have to hire more staff in order to take on more cadets. We have a great recruitment plan, and we often have more cadets or more young people wanting to come in than we can take, but we would need to hire more staff in order to make it happen or have expensive overtime for our team leaders.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. So you're only at capacity because of the staff that you have. I'm not asking you to throw money away. I'm just wondering what your opinion is if you were able to take in the additional cadets that apply if you had the staff, whether you think that would be beneficial to troubled youth and the youth that apply.
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, we absolutely think it would be beneficial to Alaska. The benefit of the National Guard Youth Challenge programs around the country has been well recorded by RAND Corporation studies that for every dollar invested in a National Guard Youth Challenge program, it saves $2.66 of societal costs. Our Youth Challenge program is widely regarded as always being in the top five in the country, arguably, you know, number one or number two every year. We have a very proactive pre-apprenticeship program, which Bob is going to describe for you a little later. And we believe in the program, and beyond that, I think that the statistics of the success of our program speak for itself.
For the record, this is Deputy Commissioner Dole picking up the testimony at this point. The director of the Alaska Military Youth Academy, Bob Roses, will be down in Juneau on Tuesday and Wednesday of this coming week and available to go in detail about your questions about the vocational training program we've been able to leverage U.S. Department of Labor funds to deliver, as well as some collaboration he's working on Monday for a more logical succession for those once they graduate the academy. And we'll make sure to try to get him on your schedule Tuesday or Wednesday if we can find a spot for that. As you can see from the slide that's up, we discussed reduce and maintain. The other area is grow. And before going into grow, some of these also involve requests for increments this year. Wanted to explain, we pride ourselves on being a compliance-based organization. And in talking with some of members of this committee, we were asked why we didn't approach LBNA previously. And we looked at Alaska Statute 3707080, as well as Alaska Statute 3705146. As well as the Alaska Legislative Budget Handbook dated October of 2016, and we missed the requirement to do so in looking at those documents. We're going to go back and revise our processes so we're more able to meet the expectations of this committee. But just when we looked at the materials we thought were relevant to it, we didn't spot that requirement. Where our mission dictated, we're proposing increased investment. First, following in the 2016 National Defense Authorization Act passed by Congress and in response to the retirement of legacy C-130 aircraft assigned to the Alaska Air National Guard, earlier this year, the United States Air Force transferred 8 C-17 strategic airlift aircraft from the active duty component to the Alaska Air National Guard. This action not only preserves strategic airlift capabilities supporting Pacific Command, but restores and improves similar capabilities for the state to support relief operations during disasters, search and rescue missions, and other civil support requirements. While the aircraft and their maintenance requirements remain fully federally funded, we gained operations and maintenance responsibility for 3 facilities on Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, totaling more than 480,000 square feet, a large aircraft hangar, and 2 additional support facilities in particular. This new requirement brought on 5 new maintenance facilities positions, which are 75% supported by federal funds. Additionally, this action preserves the existing 200-person airlift squadron, which is part of the 176th Wing, continues to support the jump training and readiness of the 4th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, 25th Infantry Division at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson, and keeps the Rapid Reaction Force capability at Fort Wainwright ready and relevant by having airlift in close proximity to react rapidly when world crises arise. On the timing of this request, when considering mission changes such as this or new mission bed-downs such as the F-35 deployments to Eielson Air Force Base, the Air Force uses a process called a Site Activation Task Force, or SATAF, we love our acronyms, to assess all the elements necessary to make the mission successful. These include manpower, facilities, and other support requirements. For this action, the SATAF's results outlining the transfer of the 3 facilities to the Alaska Air National Guard and the need for an additional 5 labor, trade, and craft positions to operate and maintain them wasn't finalized until this summer, well after the previous session ended. The next area, additionally, to promote further engagement in and provide opportunity to rural Alaska, we propose further expansion of the Alaska State Defense Force to include a new 80-person headquarters element in Bethel and 370-person scout elements elsewhere in the state. This $210,000 increment provides funding for initial equipment and supplies for this new organization. During the hurricanes in the southeastern United States this past fall, the value of state guards was invaluable. The state of Texas is calling for doubling their Texas State Guard from 2,500 to 5,000 based on the success there. In fact, our own Alaska State Defense Force ended up deploying to assist with communications capabilities in Puerto Rico after the disaster. And by the way, their cost will be 100% paid by FEMA for their support there. Furthermore, following early last summer, as the previous session drew to a close, and after attending an Association of Defense Community Symposium in Washington, D.C., while the proposed base realignment and closure language for the 2018 National Defense Authorization Act was being written, it became evident to us that Alaska's posture to protect and potentially grow DOD investment in the state was passive and reactive at best. With all due respect, we'd posit the United States military presence in Alaska has been taken for granted. For many decades, Alaska coasted on a formula based on 3 things: World War II and Cold War infrastructure, Senator Ted Stevens, and geostrategic location. World War II was 70 years ago. Cold War ended nearly 20 years ago. Sandra Stevens tragically passed away 8 years ago, and the geostrategic location remains. Recent attempted force reductions of the 425 at Joint Base Elmendorf-Richardson and F-16s at Eielson are signs of the need to step up our game. Additionally, to increase the responsiveness and lethality of the Air Force, the recently released, as in last Friday, 2018 National Defense Strategy states, the Department will also work to reduce excess property and infrastructure, providing Congress with options for a base realignment and closure. Other states are ramping up competition, too, to gain force structure in their states. 35 other states have military affairs offices concerned with force structure and military base issues, with more than half of these having been created since 2011. Half of all states report they retain a private lobbyist in Washington, D.C. to lobby on these issues. According to the Association of Defense Community Survey, the average amount spent was $300,000 annually. According to the same survey, 75% of states report they take advantage of DOD Office of Economic Adjustment grants. The state of Alaska has never applied for these funds. While a priority of Commissioner Hummel's and the department, DMVA has struggled with the bandwidth, and the new position is in the process of coordinating a 2018 grant application for a supply chain study, as just now working with the project manager on this particular project. And going back to the other states, the average state has 2 to 6 full-time employees of the 75% that have, or the 60%, the two-thirds that have folks dedicated to military force structure. We're asking for one. Many other states also bond for infrastructure projects to assist bases. Some award dollars directly. For example, the state of Texas created a $30 million grant program in 2017 to match community dollars on base-related infrastructure projects. Projects that typically lower utility costs. Not that's what we're recommending, but a Texas legislator passed subsequent legislation to make the process immune from Freedom of Information Act requests so the competition couldn't request materials on their work. The military facility zones are a good step forward, but we believe we need more beyond that. This is also a time of new opportunity. After a decade of more of bipartisan focus through two administrations, the Pentagon and Congress are beginning to wake up to threats from a changing Arctic. One outcome is down payment on one polar-class icebreaker. However needed, that's not likely to be a home port in Alaska. North Korea's bellicose stance in the work of Senator Sullivan led to investments in the ground-based missile defense at Fort Greely. So this is a time of opportunity wherein we need to seize the day in a smart and cost-effective yet still aggressive way. As state legislators understand, two things are critical to functioning of government and legislative bodies in particular: personal relationships and being in the right place when things start to move. Having staff in D.C. in particular helps on both accounts. In the past 2 weeks alone, the Special Assistant has met with the Association of Defense Communities, the National Guard Association, the Department of Defense officials, the U.S. Coast Guard Senior Arctic Policy Advisor, the NOAA Senior Arctic Policy Advisor, National Governors Association staff, and colleagues with similar responsibilities for other states. This is, of course, in addition to closely coordinating with our congressional delegation. In summary on this topic, whereas most states have 2 to 6 full-time personnel on board to perform this important mission, Alaska has none. As such, on December 1st of 2017, we brought on an additional special assistant position stationed in the governor's office in Washington, D.C. to save on per diem and travel to take on this task. Our final two areas, if you look at the two bullets up to there, I will address together. These are both 100% federal funded positions that drive an increase in PCNs and federal receipt authority. Finally, continuing efforts to leverage other fund sources, we found opportunity to bring on 2 additional 100% federally reimbursed positions to carry on critical tasks in the department. First, an emergency management specialist in our Army National Guard component will assist with support planning and preparedness actions and further synergize efforts between our State Emergency Operations Center and our National Guard Joint Operations Center. Additionally, an airport leasing specialist, which is really a property specialist, but with the job descriptions we describe as such, will take on the task of tracking and maintaining our inventory of facilities and infrastructures supporting our Army National Guard, an effort previously done by a military member. However, that position was recently deleted by the National Guard Bureau, which in turn is providing funding for this.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Co-Chair, with apologies, I'm going to excuse myself with your permission. to attend to a competing training requirement. But as on any battlefield, when the commander goes down, the guidon is picked up by the lieutenants. And so these two retired colonels on either side of me have it well in hand.
Thank you, and we have two questions, the time for the end of the presentation is 10 minutes after 2, so you may need to summarize your positions as they go to get through the budget. Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have two questions. The first one is very relevant to this week and the emergency management planning. Have you started the review on your preparedness with the tsunami warning that we had earlier this week? And have you looked at that? I mean, I know you probably had this done before that and all your backup done, but it's always appropriate to look back and say, were we ready? Especially when the alert becomes a stand down.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the shortest answer is yes, we have conducted a thorough after-action review. However, we have federal partners on this. There is an opportunity next week where our Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management is meeting with his federal counterparts as well to do a synergized look at both the federal sensors that fed the warning as well as the state response to look at what worked, what we want to improve, and what actions we need to take to better serve Alaskans in the future.
And another question, Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Guttenberg.
Thank you. So my favorite ping pong in Department of Military and Veterans Affairs is, what's the status of the Vet Cemetery in Fairbanks?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, the short answer at this hour is I'm not totally sure. The reason I'm saying that is last hour, Governor Walker up in Fairbanks met with the mayors of Fairbanks, the borough, and the city to discuss two proposed parcels and to obtain community feedback with a view towards finalizing a plan and reducing the contract to proceed towards one of those. But he's just discussed the issue with the two mayors up there about the time we were getting ready to come to talk to you all.
Thank you.
Representative Foster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very quickly, Deputy Commissioner, going back to the expansion of the Alaska State Defense Force for rural engagement, two questions regarding the 80 people down in Bethel. You had mentioned all but one would be part-time. Are we looking at the average person would be putting in 4 hours a week, 4 hours a month?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, the typical Alaska State Defense member, and this includes the detachments we've since opened in Queethluk and Quinnahawk, with discussions going on of the one about to open in Kotzebue, puts in a weekend. That weekend is typically 2 8-hour days where they prepare for serving their fellow Alaskans in time of need. This is all done at their own expense on their own time.
Thank you. And Mr. Chairman?
Co-Chair Foster.
The second question, as you mentioned, it would require an increment of $210,000. And would that be the state's portion, or would it be $210,000 total, and some part of that could be filled in with federal dollars?
Through the chair, Representative Foster, in this case, it's both. There is no federal commitment to funding at this point. We have made proposals to address how this meets federal Department of Homeland Security needs. However, as we sit here today, there is no federal commitment to funds. There are some 501c3 funds that are being donated, though, to the effort from organizations and individuals in Alaska at whom this is important.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, picking back up, and we'll hurry to get us through the rest of the pitch. So for FY18 supplementals, we mentioned both the C-17 mission gain and our new special assistant position. And additionally, there's a proposal for an increase to the disaster relief fund, which I'll discuss in a later slide. Moving on to capital, our capital request consists of federal authority only, allowing opportunity to continue use of grants received to support our homeland security missions across the state. Specifically, our state Homeland Security Program and pre-disaster mitigation grant program, which increase mitigation preparedness, response, and recovery capability for local and state government. Now, this new appropriation considers the use of older appropriations, which we hit and draw down first, and so those are balanced year to year. So this number will fluctuate from year to year. That's why it looks different from previous years. And additionally, our capital budget requests include receipt authority associated with the National Guard Counter-Drug Support Program, which supports law enforcement agencies and drug enforcement operations, and assists in training law enforcement officers and provides community-based drug awareness programs. So what our team does here is provide intelligence to support to this effort, and we'd serve to share in the proceeds of sale of assets seized and sold under the U.S. Department of Justice Asset Forfeiture Program, which, of course, is designed to deter that criminal activity. And then finally, while there's no deferred maintenance requirements specifically in our budget, we know the legislature is taking up consideration of the Alaska Economic Recovery Plan, and if passed, we would look to compete with other agencies for maybe a portion of that pie for our deferred maintenance backlog. So this slide shows our manpower levels from 2008 to 18, and I'll summarize. When you combine the history with actions taken in our FY19 budget submission, what we've seen is a net reduction of almost 20% over the past 6 years and 63 positions net taken off the books. Now, as mentioned previously, our proposed 19 budget does show a net growth of 7 positions, 2 of which are 100% federally funded, 5 of which are 75% federally funded, 25 state, 1 of which is 100% GF, and there was one non-permanent position that we took off the books as we could not get ourselves into agreement with the local bargaining union to be able to hire into it, so we've taken that off the books.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Could you, on the 16 that you have that was removed from the academy in FY17, was that because you dropped an enrollment? What was the thought process on that big of a cut at that time?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, there is two things there. First, we found we had positions we did not foresee a funding to be able to utilize. And second, we had to make some cutbacks in some area, and we eliminated some filled positions and found we could maintain, by finding improved scheduling and efficiencies, we could produce the same level of service with fewer people. So we laid off some people. And we also had, if you saw the vacancy factor briefing that for us Lacey Sanders gave for our committee, we had some positions like that that were just floating that hadn't been filled for years. And rather than having an empty PCN of a shell, we removed it for more transparency.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up, Representative Wilson.
So if you could just get it to us, I know there's federal funds that are normally tied to the academy, depending upon what we've done in the state. If it's just you can't fill the positions, that's what you did it. But if there's something we could do so more Alaskans can take advantage of this, that would be great to know that you could just give us to it in an email. But if you can't fill the positions, then that's a whole different issue.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we require additional state funding to get an additional Fed match, and we'll provide an email to lay out the options. It's basically tiered levels. We'd have to grow up another tier, and that would drive a certain growth of personnel and funds. And we'll just give a written answer on that. It's easier.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, picking back up. So with our programs currently operating at the minimum levels to avoid mission failure, recruitment retention is a key focus area for our leadership. We've generally been successful in filling vacant positions timely. We do have our instances where we remain challenged. Specifically, our internet specialist position in the department is on its fourth recruitment action within a year, with interviews scheduled in the very near future. And additionally, our Alaska Aerospace teammates show a long-term vacancy, which they can speak to you on in a separate hearing.
Mr. Chair, the following three slides show details on our allocations programs with details on the funding, the number of employees in each, the populations, and what requires us to do those in the first place, state or federal laws or the Constitution. I believe they speak for themselves, and in the interest of time, I would recommend we just pass over these, and we'll respond to any written questions afterwards, unless there's any specific concerns. The one I would note here that the National Guard headquarters does go to zero because we propose transferring those two positions, getting rid of that separate line and putting it into the Office of the Commissioner. And if there's no questions, I'll pass this back to Assistant Director Duffy to proceed on with health care.
Mr. Chairman, Brian Duffy, Admin Services Director, picking back up. So health care costs for our department, mainly the state contribution to employee plans and workers' comp payments, average between 8% to 9% over the last several years and generally trend with most of the other departments. But when you focus specifically on the DMVA, you can see here our health care costs over time with those breakouts I mentioned previously. And I guess I would attribute the downward trend overall primarily to the reduction positions we've seen over the last 6 years. Now, if you set cost aside, we are focused as a department on promoting a healthy lifestyle. Our uniformed members of the National Guard must comply with height, weight, and fitness standards. We offer a variety of wellness programs to our members and their families. Our major operating locations, such as in Anchorage and right up the street in Auk Bay, have or in close proximity to buildings or areas for fitness activities. Our Alaskan Military Youth Academy cadets and cadre participate in regular physical activity. And on the topic of spiritual wellness, our National Guard chaplain team is available to all of our members, whether in uniform or not. As mentioned earlier, our disaster relief fund includes a number of proposals for increase in both the FY18 supplemental and FY19 budget. It is executed under authority vested in Alaska Statute 2629-300. That disaster relief fund provides a legislatively approved, readily available fund source to speed relief and recovery actions during various emergency situations. So in general, when an event occurs, local jurisdictions will perform the initial response. If the events exceed their capacity, they may request assistance from the state, following which the DMVA commissioner will convene a multi-agency disaster policy council to review the facts and circumstances surrounding the event and prepare recommendations for the governor to consider. Now, as you can see the lower part of the slide, cost estimate thresholds dictate actions required by the executive branch, and in response to more severe situations, include required approvals by the legislature. This slide depicts the final authorized history over the last 6 years for our disaster relief fund. The UGF figures shown include all actions taken by the legislature to appropriate funding for this purpose, be it through the governor's budget proposal, supplementos, or other authorized actions. And additionally, it shows the amount of federal funding authorized during the same period for requests that were approved at that level. Now, many of you may recall the devastation seen following the spring breakup of the Yukon and Koyukuk Rivers in 2013 in May, wherein the communities of Circle and Galena experienced catastrophic impacts from both riverine flooding and the ballistic impact of river ice. In Galena, almost 90% of all residences and public and commercial infrastructure that was located outside of the ring levee protecting the runway and the Galena Interior Learning Academy were impacted by floodwaters and ice. This necessitated the emergency evacuation of a majority of the residents to both Fairbanks and Anchorage. And due to the severity of the disaster and the impact to individuals and families, the governor authorized implementation of both the Individual and Family Grant, or IFG, program and the Temporary Housing Program. In addition, the President of the United States also declared the disaster and implemented the federal version of the IFG. The damage was so widespread and severe that the state of Alaska and FEMA provided temporary housing and emergency sheltering for upwards of 18 months in order to mobilize resources and volunteer agencies to rebuild and repair homes that were destroyed or damaged from the floods in each community. And in addition to that disaster, two more disasters were declared in that fiscal year, namely the October Kenai Peninsula borough floods and what were known as the 2013 November storms. And moving on, in terms of our current fiscal picture, at the beginning of this week, our DRF balance is approximately $4.8 million. We recently had two declared disasters in the state, the North Slope and the Kenai Peninsula borough storms, which are projected to decrement this amount by approximately $3.5 million, leaving only $1.3 million as our projected available balance as we approach the window for breakup in 2018. And so our $2 million request in the FY19 budget, combined with the amount being finalized for submission as a potential FY18 supplemental appropriation, will restore our DRF to a level which will help us rapidly respond to communities in crisis and aid in their recovery.
Deputy Commissioner Dole, wrapping up with the leave of the chair. In summary, we're a small department with a big impact. We set our funding levels and personnel levels by turning to our federal partners and finding the minimum level we could go at to still participate in those programs and reducing staff to match those. Mr. Chair, that concludes the final portion of our briefing. We're certainly glad to take questions you may have now or in writing to supplement given the time constraints.
And we will submit questions, and also the subcommittees can pick up this in more detail. Are there any questions that anybody had, immediate concerns? Seeing none, thank you very much for the presentation. Now we'll take a brief at ease while we set up for the Department of Health and Social Services. call the meeting back over to order, and we have Commissioner of the Social Services, welcome, and we should look at trying to get through the presentation by about 3:10. Just schedule timing. Would you go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, and if we're going to be switching back to female voices, please just say your name when you make a response or when you switch.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Seaton and Foster and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Nuhahala Kamitlamaganan Valerie Davidson. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. Here with me today at the table is Shonda O'Brien, Assistant Commissioner. Also here in the room are John Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner, who's sitting behind me. Karen Forrest, also Deputy Commissioner. Dr. Jay Butler, who serves as our Chief Medical Officer. Also Tony Newman, our Legislative Liaison for the Department. Our eight division directors are either on the phone or in the room. Amanda Lofgren, Director of the Alaska Pioneer Homes, is on the phone. Randall Burns, Director of the Division of Behavior Health, is here in the room. Margaret Brody, the Director of Healthcare Services, is available on the phone. Tracy Dompling, Director of the Division of Juvenile Justice, is on the phone. Tracy Spartz-Campbell is the Deputy Director of the Office of Children's Services. She is here in person, standing in for Christy Lawton, the Director, who is out on medical. Monica Windham, Director of the Division of Public Assistance, is also here behind us today, or maybe in front of you behind me. Dr. Jay Butler, who in addition to being Chief Medical Officer, also serves as the Director of the Division of Public Health, and Dwayne Mays, the Director of Senior and Disability Services, is available on the phone. This is information that we've seen before, so I'm going to try and zip through as much information and provide as much of the highlight as possible while perhaps giving you a little bit of a tease for some of the juicy stuff, but getting into more of the juicy stuff when we get into the division presentations. As you all know, the Department of Health and Social Services was established in 1919 through the Territorial Health Department, and on statehood in 1959. Our responsibilities were expanded to provide for the promotion and the protection of public health and also public welfare, which is found in the Constitution. These links include our department homepage and also other resources that may be helpful for folks who are at home looking for more information about the department. Our constitutional authority is found in the second link. They're found in Article 7. The duties of the department can be found in statute in Title 47, and our FY19 proposed department budget is found at the link on the last piece. I'm going to try to speak quickly without sounding like an auctioneer. Our next four slides are actually prepared by the Legislative Finance Division, and Assistant Commissioner Shonda O'Brien will be covering these.
For the record, my name is Shonda O'Brien. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Health and Social Services. So the slide you see on page 3 shows you a picture of our general fund budget to include our designated general funds. From 2019 to the current year, you'll see from here that the trend has been going down up until the most recent year. The FY19 budget request includes our increase to the Medicaid program, and so as we get through this presentation, we'll get a little bit more detail about the Medicaid request. Slide 4 just gives you the picture of the entire funding for the department by line item. And so from this slide, you can see that the majority of our funding really is in our grants and benefits line. The grants and benefits are, the majority of those are really benefits going to recipients in Alaska, some of which, though, are also paid out through grants to various grantees across the state. Our grants program has been growing steadily, and you'll see that most of the other line items have remained fairly consistent over the years. Slide 5 is a breakout of our budget by general fund dollars only for by division. So you'll see Down at the bottom of the chart, there's a breakout for all of the different divisions in the department and how their funding has kind of trended over the years. There's not a significant amount of change to the department or to the divisions across the department, with the exception of the Medicaid program, which you see at the very top. The Medicaid funds that you see there represent what's in the governor's budget in FY19. They don't represent the general fund request in the supplemental budget currently. So for FY18, it looks lower than what we've requested in our supplemental budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I understand about the $127 million growth, because the $100 million should have been in last year's, from my understanding. But we still had a decrease. So is it because of Medicaid expansion is why we're seeing an uptick versus? I'm just trying to figure out what happened that we started going up so substantially.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wilson. So for FY18, we were on record, I believe, last year saying that we believed that our number for FY18 was not going to be 100% accurate. What we're attributing growth to, or what we're seeing as the UGF growth in the Department for Medicaid, is not attributed to expansion. Largely, the growth is due to the non-expansion categories. We've seen a lot of people enrolling. The enrollment numbers have increased quite a bit.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
And if you could get to the chairman that the growth on, and keep that separate, the Medicaid program versus the Medicaid expansion. So maybe, you know, for the last 5 years, so we could see if the growth is because of the economy or just more people learned about the program and now has access to it and didn't know.
Right. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, we do have a slide later on that kind of shows you a picture of some of that.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you remind me where the Dayhab Services program falls under these different lines? Is that senior and disability services, or where is that found?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, that is in the Medicaid program. So it's going to be grouped into that top bar where you see the green, if you're looking at a color slide, or if you're looking at the black and white, it's just the top one that has kind of a triangle shape. So it's built into that budget. It's difficult to see them separated that way.
Thank you.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. Just, Sean, I think we were through this with Director Pitney, but if we're going by expenses per fiscal year, the FY18 number in terms of expenses should be $100 million higher, and then FY19, $27 million expected growth. And then the testimony, I think, from Director Pitney was service costs. Actually, you've cut the reimbursement rates in some areas, but there's been no additional programs. Is that all correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that is correct. So if you're looking at it as though it were already expended, what we're projecting to spend in FY18 and then on into 19, there would be a $27 million difference in general fund spending only. Slide 6 just gives you the same picture, but only this shows you all the fund sources across the divisions. Again, the Medicaid number shows a larger increase between FY18 and 19, and that increase combines both our general fund request in the supplemental budget as well as the RPL that was approved earlier this year for $525 million.
So earlier you said that on the previous slide, that the 127 did not include the supplementals.
Mr. Chair, that's for our FY19 request. Our FY19 request would show that total $127 million increase in UGF. The FY18 number that's currently on this slide does not.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you. You said RPL request for $529 million?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, $525 million. That was approved in November.
Representative Guerra.
That's almost half the department's GF budget. So what is Just to, if you could briefly explain, and I guess we'll have to go sure. into more detail later, but what the...
Sure. So through the chair, Representative Guerra, the $525 million in, it was a federal authority increase that represented the increase to the Medicaid program for several of the categories in the Medicaid services areas. And so that it's federal authority, if that helps to clarify for you. So slide 7 is a picture of the Medicaid or of the funding sources across all the department. I thought I would take a moment to pause here and give you a highlight of some of the budget changes that we've put into the FY19 budget that aren't specifically pointed out in slides further on. So the biggest changes, of course, are through the Medicaid program, which we'll go into more detail about. The other changes to the department's FY19 budget really are more in line with technical changes, some of which are an increase in funding to the Office of Children's Services to fully fund the positions that were added in the FY17 budget or the FY18 budget. So you'll see a slight increase, not easily identifiable on this slide, but in their budget, we've asked for a total of $1.4 million, bringing that level of funding up to fully fund those positions. We've also asked for $6.5 million in federal authority in the Office of Children's Services budget, in line with a RPL request we had last year, due to increased federal claiming potential from some efficiencies that we were able to achieve in our cost allocation process. And then the Pioneer Homes is also increasing their federal authority or their federal receipt authority to accommodate an increase they're going to be getting in reimbursement from the Veterans Administration starting in October of this coming year. Some other things, I think the largest change, which isn't identifiable on this slide, is that last year we were able to utilize some features in our accounting system to better identify the sources of funding in the department that are truly general fund match versus the funding sources that are GF. So you'll see a very large amount of funding across the department throughout all our components that represents a change from general funds to general fund match, and it's about $130 million. The other thing on here I think that came up yesterday in the subcommittee hearing was there's a request in the governor's budget to continue funding for the senior benefits program. So it's not a budget change. You're not going to see it reflected as a change necessarily from FY18 to FY19. However, that program is due to sunset this year, so that is it's reflected currently as an increment in the budget.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I thought there was a waiver that was supposed to be available that we were going, and there were so many that year, so I couldn't tell you what the number was, but did that not pan out?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, nothing was passed last year to extend the program.
Can I try again? It wasn't passed. I think it was in SB 74. There was waivers. I thought we were going to be able to be eligible for that particular program to offset some of the costs, so it was not a new bill.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think you might be confusing that with the Senior and Disability Services program. This is the senior benefits program that's in the public assistance budget.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Slide number 8 is the Medicaid budget broken out over the past several years, starting with FY15. This slide is really meant to show a picture of how the budget for the Medicaid services has grown. However, our general fund spending, or our general fund budget for FY19 is still under the FY15 UGF amount. So as the program has continued to grow, this really highlights all of the work and the effort going on in the department to reduce our general fund spending in the program through reform efforts and other activity that's taking place. Slide 9 is the slide that kind of gets to what Representative Wilson was asking about earlier, where we give you a picture, not so much economically, but it gives you a breakout of our population as the Medicaid enrollment is compared to it. So the very bottom part of the slide highlights Medicaid enrollment starting in 2000 And then you'll see the population at that time was just over 600,000, below 700,000. And it has steadily continued to increase until the last couple of years. I do believe that the Department of Labor's most recent statistics are showing that there is a slight decrease. And then as we get into years 2016, you'll see a breakout for the expansion enrollment as compared to the regular Medicaid enrollment. And so that is the yellow color that you see in the bar chart up through 2019. And what we're projecting for 18 and 19 are on track with how we've seen things trending.
Oyana Shanda, this is Val again. Slide 10, these next several slides really are a presentation of the department programs and component level details that the committee has seen this information before. So we've numbered these because there are 98 rows of programs within our department. I think different from military and veterans affairs that you heard earlier, we are a big department with a big impact. So we've numbered these rows just so that it makes it easier to track. The gray rows that you see are the roll-ups, either for the department in the first instance in row one or in row two for that particular division. You can see moving forward, I think this is all information that you've seen before. I will point out one in terms of the rating of effectiveness. If you move, rating of the importance to mission, which is kind of in the middle of the slide, you can see that green section, or slightly shaded if you're looking at a black and white version. Let's go to number three, for example, under Pioneer Homes. The rating of that was critical, and we used the Finance Committee's criteria from last year and carried that over. Critical means it's directly accomplishing the department's constitutional or statutory authority mission statement. Important was it may not directly relate to core services, but perhaps provides indirect supports and services that it would need to be reassigned if that program didn't exist. And then if you move one over to the right, you'll see a rating of effectiveness column. And we used a scale of 1 through 3. A scale of one, a rating of 1 means we're getting the job done. A rating of 2, we're getting the job done, but we see rating of 2 is we're getting the job done, but we see substantial opportunity for improvement. And a rating of 3 is we're not getting the job done, and we really see limited opportunity for improvement. So in row, you can see the department total, $3.25 billion total funds, which is comprised of $1.165 million in UGF, $79.1 million in designated general funds, $1.885 billion in federal, and then $123.146 million in other, and those are typically program receipts. So moving into the specific divisions, you can see the Pioneer Homes, row 2 is the division total, and the Alaska Pioneer Homes is 1.95% of the department's overall budget. Our their total is $663.34 million. The rows here, row 3 is the Pioneer Homes Management, and row 4 is really the majority of the staffing and that component that provides services directly in the homes. On slides 11 and 12, the Division of Behavioral Health, row 5, is the division total. The total budget is $133.4 million. And that represents 4.1% of the overall budget. And for these ones that have a lot of rows, we're going to emphasize a couple of things, not go through every one. We thought you would want to know the area that has the largest number of employees and also the area that has the largest UGF. And so in this division, slide 11, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute has the largest number of employees, or 252. And some things you should know about API, or the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. It is an 80-bed facility. Has been quite notorious lately in the news media. The history, though, of API is that in 1963, I believe, when the old API existed, it was actually over 220-bed facility. In 1965, it was the highest bed facility at 225, and 2 years before I was born. And then there was an effort really nationally to move folks away from institutional level of care, especially for folks who live with disabling conditions and folks who are dealing with serious and chronic mental illness. And at the time, there was a feasibility study. There was an effort to deinstitutionalize folks starting in 1973, where those numbers, the number of occupancy at the old API facility began to decline. It was quite intentional on the state's part. Every state was doing that. When the new facility was being contemplated, there was a feasibility study that was done that recommended a 124-bed facility, which also identified 40 forensic beds. I think at the time there was a compromise that was made to do 80 beds, and so rather than 124-bed facility, we have 80 beds, and rather than 40 forensic beds, we have 10. So it shouldn't surprise anyone. It doesn't really matter what line of business you're in. If you go from a capacity of 225 down to 80, there's going to definitely be some adjustment, and we're certainly feeling that impact now. And hindsight, of course, is always 2020. We know more information now than we had before at the time. Well, certainly more than I did, because I wasn't born yet. But folks, you know, made the best decisions based upon the information they had at the time. Now that we know more, we might have done things differently. The other thing you should know about API that is impacting our level of care is we are required to do a JCO accreditation every year. It's a Joint Commission for the Accreditation of Hospital Organizations or Healthcare Organizations. And we are requiring to do remodels of the rooms and the some of the fixtures in the bathrooms and the doors. And so that remodel has begun now. And so we are now going to be down 10 beds in the first phase. And we will be down, when that is done, we will also move to phase two, and we will be down 10 beds in a different wing of the facility. So that has been a challenge. The other that you will see in the biggest UGF in behavioral health is in line six, in row six, for the treatment and recovery grants. We really appreciate this committee's effort on being able to do address substance use disorders in our state. The $6 million that was provided before has really had an impact in our community. We also... As Assistant Commissioner mentioned, as a part of the Governor's Public Safety Action Plan, there is a multi-year request for an additional $18 million to help us address some of the things that we're seeing in the addiction, especially in opioid crisis in Alaska.
Before we go on further, Representative Tilt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Commissioner. A question on in behavioral health and all throughout DHSS. There's a large majority of grants, and they are growing. So a concern that we have is just on the metrics that are being kept on the grants for their effectiveness and successfulness, and just making sure that we're not overlapping services. Can you talk to us about that?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, we can get you some of that information, but I will tell you that our biggest opportunity for that change is going to come with our 1115 waiver, which today is the 26th, so in 5 days, on the 31st, we will be submitting our application to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services for our 1115 behavioral health waiver. We have worked with tribes, we've worked with stakeholders, providers, beneficiaries across the state for the last couple of years to really change how we address behavioral health services in our state. the way that the things that are most often funded right now through behavioral health is really the really high acuity level of care. And what we are asking CMS to allow us to be able to do with the waiver is to really do earlier interventions much sooner so that folks don't rise to the level of acuity that we are seeing today. And one of the parts, one of the requirements of that 1115 waiver will be requiring performance metrics and measures as well.
Thank you. Also, I'm just talking about the streamlining of the documentation as far as behavioral health. I know back when I was working in as an aide on this budget, that was one of the big challenges, was just streamlining some of the documentation. I know there was a group form that was looking at that. Is that gone anywhere, or how are we doing that as well?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, we can get you that information. We can provide that to you. One of the challenges we have, though, throughout all of our programs, though, is we have seen an increase in the amount of federal reporting requirements. So sometimes in healthcare, it feels like we take one step forward and we take a step and a half, or sometimes two steps back. But we can provide that to the committee.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Slides, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On line 8, dealing with Behavioral Health Administration, and 9 of the grants, and a lot of the grants recipients always have issues. And line 8 in the administration of those grants, rating effectiveness, you give it a 2. And I think our grant recipients always have issues with how the grants are administered. So what actions are you taking to improve that effectiveness so that administration of the grants are more effective? Because it really, it runs down into the administration of the grants and how services are delivered.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, one of our big efforts and our big, quite frankly, impetus for being able to do the 1115 demonstration waiver are to be able to remove a lot of those barriers. Quite frankly, there are times I think that sometimes, and it's hard to admit this sometimes publicly, and I probably shouldn't on the record, but I'll just be honest that sometimes we are sometimes the impediment to being able to make progress. But when I say that word we, I'll just say I try. No, when things are going poorly, I try to say I. When things are going well, I do try to say we. But we certainly heard that from our stakeholders as we were developing the 1115 waiver. It's, you know, you're killing us with all of this administrative burden. How can we do things a little bit more effectively? The thing with an 1115 waiver that is so helpful to us as a state is it waives requirements of the Social Security Act, which are all of those federal requirements that we unfortunately have to pass through to our grantees. So having the opportunity to waive some of those requirements is really going to be make a huge difference for us.
And just one other thing real briefly, in that line 8, column 2, the last number, 7,002, is that a number or is that a cost code? Because we see that cost code, 7,002, in other places. If you could just check, it doesn't matter. It just line 8, the second column.
Oh.
That's okay. You can get back with me. That's fine.
I'm not sure what I did, but I made the screen dark.
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, that's the, if you're talking about the 700.2 mm-hmm. with other after, that's a fund source.
Okay, thank
yes.
you.
So slides 13 and 14, the Office of Children's Services, row 15 is the division total. $163.97 million represents a little over 5% of the overall budget. Row 18, the frontline staff are the majority of the employees. And rows 20 through 23 are the foster care and adoption and guardianship payments formula. We also want to thank the committee for the additional staff in frontline staff. We are, for the first time in the first quarter of FY18, seeing 23 more children were discharged, then were removed. For many years, we really struggled with, we had more removals than we had discharges, or kids moving out of the system or moving into permanent placement. Then we had reports and of kids that we were getting reports of harm and dealing with those cases. And we're really fortunate. I know that those positions made a difference. For the first time in many years, in FY18, in the first quarter, we're seeing more discharges than removal. And that's a really significant change if you go back several years. Between the state fiscal years 14 through 16, where 30% more children were removed rather than discharged. So we're seeing a trend in the right direction, and we appreciate the funds from the legislature that have allowed us to do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on that line 18, so I'm showing a difference. It appears that there's 66 vacant positions, I guess, at least at this time, when this presentation was put together. And in the book or whatever, when I'm looking at the vacancy rate, showing I'm doing my homework, it has the vacancy rate is changed from 2018 to 2019, where you had a vacancy rate that was 2.5 million. Now it's 1.6 million. That $921,000 difference, is that now $921,000 of UGF that you can now spend because it's not part of the vacancy rate? Or why is that change?
Through the chair, Representative Olson, are you speaking about the budgeted vacancy rate differences from year to year?
Yes.
What we do in every year is we evaluate how we spent in the prior year, how we claimed our federal funds, and how spending takes place across the division and the department to see if there needs to be an alignment of funding to how we anticipate spending to occur in the next year. Oftentimes, we're kind of caught in the middle of spending because we're closing out a budget year when we're building the management plan for the current year and then also developing the budget for the following year. So it's a process that usually requires staff to do a couple of different things to estimate whether there's going to be changes. What you're seeing in the differences in the vacancy rates for this, I assume you're talking about frontline social worker, but across all of our components, you'll see a fluctuation depending on if funding's changed somehow, if we've gotten increments such as the one we received last year, that could have an impact on how much we need to budget for a vacancy rate. Sometimes we see changes because we've deleted positions or funding is no longer available in certain areas, and so we shift funding sources to other line items. So that change represents an alignment of how the positions are being funded and where we aligned to how we spent in FY17.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Wilson.
And if we could just get, all I'm trying to understand on the difference, and, you know, because that's a substantial difference, mm-hmm. is whether or not now, without adding any more positions or anything, there'll be 921,000. Is it UGF? Is it like federal UGF? I mean, you can go back and look, but if you could just help me better understand, because this is just for that one area. I don't expect you to know it right now, but I am trying to figure out how what we learned and then some of these substantial changes, mm-hmm. what that means as far as how much money may be going out of the coffers that wasn't before because you had to hold those months open for vacancies.
Sure. Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I can get you more specific detail that relates specifically to that component, but the money that is appropriated to the frontline social worker component by line item didn't change. So how we fund the positions is how you're seeing that change, not the overall funding for the entire budget.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. This is Val again. Slides 15 and 16 are healthcare services, and row 24 is the division total, a total of 21.866 million, or 0.67% of the overall budget. And these are, you can see in row 28, medical assistance administration are the majority of employees. These are the folks that get all the Medicaid claims paid. They're also the folks who are doing a lot of the Senate Bill 74 work. I should note for the committee, though, that the Medicaid numbers are not in this division. They are actually some of our last slides that you'll see Medicaid, the actual Medicaid expenditures broken out. Slides 17 and 18, row 30 is, slides 17 and 18 are the Division of Juvenile Justice. Row 30 is a division total of $58.4 million, which represents 1.8% of the overall department's budget. You can see rows 31 through 39. The majority of the employees are really tied directly through to client services in either facilities or in probation services. You will also note that the Nome Youth Facility was added back into the base budget in FY18, and we have also carried that forward in 19. Year to date, just because folks were curious about, well, what is the utilization of the Nome Youth Facility? It's a 14-bed facility, and the average daily population has been 7 youth, but today there are 10. We are also converting 4 of those beds to long-term treatment beds for youth in juvenile detention, at the recommendation of the consultant report that was provided a couple of years ago. Slides 19 and 20, the Division of Public Assistance. Row 43 is a division total, $299.028 million, or 9.19% of the overall department budget. Row 53, field services are the majority of employees, providing services directly to Alaskans. Row 45, if I go back to that line, adult public assistance is the largest UGF program, which also satisfies the maintenance of effort requirement for Medicaid. And as was pointed out earlier by Assistant Commissioner O'Brien, row 49 is senior benefits.
Just for the committee's sake, I think probably folks remember, so we reduced funds to adult public assistance last year, moved those over to OCS, and we were somewhat assured that nobody would be short-funded in adult public assistance, and that was the case. Is that correct, that nobody was short-funded in adult public assistance? We met our obligations there?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's true.
Slides 21 through 24, the Division of Public Health. Row 58 is the division total, $117.372 million, represents 3.6% of the overall department's budget. Line 59, Public Health Nursing, has the largest number of employees in this division. Row 69 on page 24, the community health grants, you can see that number is not, it's been zeroed out. The community health aid training grants have been refinanced through the Medicaid program. They're limited in this budget as a component. That's something that worked out very well for the state, because when they were in this line item, they were 100% general funded through general funds. Now that we have moved those over to Medicaid, those are funded with significant federal match, and are included in the community health aid and practitioner, behavioral health aid and practitioner rates. And since those are only provided in rural locations, when it's an IHS beneficiary who receives, who is also a Medicaid beneficiary who receives their care in an IHS facility, those are, the state gets 100% federal match. So a significant general fund savings there. Senior and Disability Services, slides 25 through 28. Row 70 is a division total, $61.86 million, or 1.9% of the overall budget. I should point out that row 73, Senior and Disabilities Services Administration, is the bulk of the program. This is a little bit of a misnomer, though. We don't have 166 admin support positions in this line, in this row. The division really consolidated a lot of their staff into a single component to be able to reduce some of that administrative burden, to be able to create some efficiencies in management. And so This number includes protective services specialists, includes health program managers, includes medical assistance administrators and nurses, et cetera. And only 10 of those administrative staff, including the director, represent what you would think of as an administrative type of function. Row 71, if I go back up, consolidates all of the grant components into a single grant component as well. I believe those were three separate grants that have now been consolidated into one to realize some efficiency. Slides 29 through 31 are the department support services. Row 80 is the division total, or $42.658 million, or 1.3% of the department's overall budget. Row 88, which you can see on row 88 on slide 30, the IT services, our information technology services, are the majority of the employees. And you should also know that the IT manager and 16 employees have transferred to the Office of Information Technology at the Department of Administration. Slide 32, this is the slide that's Medicaid all day, every day, as I mentioned earlier. At the legislature's request a number of years ago, the legislature wanted to see what those Medicaid costs were because it was really confusing when they were buried within those divisions, and so this is all Medicaid. These are all services only. Row 94 is the total, $2.289 billion, 70.38% of the department's overall budget. Row 95, you can see behavioral health services. Row 96 includes adult preventive dental services. Row 97, bless you, includes healthcare Medicaid services. And row 98 includes senior and disability services.
We have a question from Representative Ortiz.
On row 98, that's where we find funding for what they call DAHAB services. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, yes, that's correct.
And I've certainly heard from, if I follow up, heard from a number of my constituents about the concerns of cutback in those DAHAB services. Has there been, with an increased funding, evidently an increased funding in overall Medicaid funds, why was there a cutback in DAHAB services?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, one of the things that we have really tried to do is to limit the amount of Medicaid growth in the Medicaid program. The increases that we are seeing in Medicaid growth are largely due to the downturn in the economy. We have more Alaskans who are actually eligible and more Alaskans who are enrolling in Medicaid. And so even with those limitations on DAHAB services, we are seeing our overall costs of Medicaid increasing. But as Assistant Commissioner mentioned earlier, Assistant Commissioner O'Brien mentioned earlier, even with the Medicaid growth that we're seeing, the overall UGF budget in FY19 and the FY19 budget request is actually less than it was in FY15.
Follow up, if I may.
Representative Ortiz.
So was it a matter of when you were saying you were trying to limit the growth or the cost growth of Medicaid services? Did you have to choose certain programs where you were going to limit that growth? In other words, was it kind of like an opportunity cost thing where you said, okay, we can't really limit it here, so we need to limit it over here? Is that kind of how it worked?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz. That's kind of it in a nutshell. What we do to manage costs or contain costs in the department for Medicaid services is we look at opportunities where it is possible, where we aren't limited by statute or regulation. And with the DAHAB services in particular, regulations were changed to accommodate a request to reduce costs to Medicaid. And so the Division of Senior and Disability Services program staff worked to modify those regulations. I think the regulations went into effect in July. And so the intent was to do as least harm as possible while still providing a level of care or services that would still benefit people.
Representative Guerra.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is maybe for a subcommittee to be sort of more detailed, but there are four categories of Medicaid services. And I think when people think about Medicaid, even sometimes when I think about Medicaid, I think of going to the doctor, going to the emergency room. But healthcare, that would be healthcare Medicaid services, right, which is about half the Medicaid budget. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. So if it's not behavioral health, if it's not adult preventive dental, if it's not senior and disabilities category of service, it falls into the healthcare Medicaid services category.
Just one follow-up, Mr. Chair.
Follow-up, Representative Guerra.
So for subcommittee, could you break, so there's a 100 for FY18 that was, I guess, misestimated, and then an extra 27 for FY19 in Medicaid. Could you, in the subcommittee, can you break down of the four categories where those funds are expected? And then also just here, when you talk about healthcare services, a senior citizen goes to the emergency room. That's healthcare services. That's not senior and disability services, right? Senior services, things like specialized Alzheimer's and other specialized senior services, correct?
Through the chair, Representative Guerra, that's correct. So for the first part of your question, yes, we'd be happy to provide that information. The second part of your question, in order for it to be considered a senior and disability services, it has to be, it's a category of service. It's not if a person who experiences a disabling condition goes to the emergency room or a person of a certain age goes to the emergency room.
Representative Guttenberg and then Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Following up on Representative Ortiz's question on the adult daycare, we talked about this a lot last year, and we had a lot of internal dialogues about it. You just explained, you know, that there was pressure, downward pressure on the budget, and the discussion with you last year was the delivery of services, which is really what it boils down to, and the number of hours available per week. And I have this note to myself that's left over from last sessions to keep it in mind. So the question becomes the delivery of services and the number of hours that are people delivered. You talked about the change of regs, and some of that was everybody had to be paid at a certain level because even though the assigned duties were different, really at the end of the day, are people getting the number of hours that they had before or comparable, or what is left on the table that is not being accomplished?
Through the chair, Representative Guttenberg, I think I understand your question. If I don't, then please redirect me. To answer your question for day rehab services, they are getting there is a cap. The cap is lower than it was before. The other thing that's happening in senior and disability services is, as you may recall, there are a number of changes that are happening at the federal level that every state must comply with. There were other things that we were doing through our refinancing efforts, and we were able to achieve quite a bit of savings through those efforts, including in FY17, our goal was to the tribal refinancing effort. Our goal was to save $32 million in state general fund dollars. We were able to actually achieve $35 million in savings. FY18, I think the goal was to save $42 million in state general fund, and we're on track to be able to meet that amount. There are other cases, and I'm getting back to senior and disability services, there are other cases in which the opportunity that we thought to be able to refinance those was not going to be possible. So, for example, 1915I and 1915K. The 1915I opportunity was something that we were hoping to be able to implement as a department to be able to save some general fund dollars by getting an enhanced federal match. However, as we looked at implementing the program, because it would convert because of the way that it would convert that program, would have actually driven up some of our state general fund costs. And so while we are still pursuing that opportunity, I think through a 1915C, there are so many alphabet letters in the Social Security Act, my apologies. We're still going to be pursuing the opportunity to ensure that those services continue. We're not going to be able to get the level of savings that we anticipated. So if you're asking me, are people going to, as particularly for dayhab services, are they going to get the same level of service? The answer is no.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wilson, then Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So with the behavioral grants and the substance abuse grants, including the $18 million the governor is asking, are the Alaskans that we are serving, are those that aren't on Medicaid or Medicaid expansion, is that the group that becomes eligible for these types of grants?
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, so maybe I can talk a little bit about the past $6 million or the $6 million that was appropriated by the legislature, and that may help us to frame how the $18 million request came together. So in FY17, the legislature appropriated $6 million. For substance use disorder treatment, and the department awarded three grants over a three-year time period. And there were, to tell you, just to be perfectly frank, none of those are possible without significant partnership and significant leverage resources from the community. And so here's an example. Central Peninsula Hospital received a $2.5 million grant to be able to do detox. They opened in August of 2017, and they have a capacity of 6 beds with the potential to increase to 10 beds. Their average length of stay is 5 beds, and many of their patients or their beneficiaries return for monthly naltrexone shots. And I mentioned the partnership earlier. The funds to purchase the facility at which that program is housed was provided by the Kenai Peninsula Borough on behalf of the hospital. A second grantee was Set Free Alaska in Mat-Su. They received a $1 million grant, and it's for residential substance use disorder treatment for women and children. It opened in August of 2017 and reached capacity by November of 2017. The capacity is 12 treatment beds for women with an additional 4 beds for their children, and the Mat-Su Health Foundation purchased the facility and contributed $400,000 for the building renovations.
And Mr. Chairman, because I know we're short on time, I don't think my question wasn't clear enough, so I just want to make sure that we have time.
Wilson.
I appreciate that. What I'm trying to figure out, though, is so those people who participated in these, were they not eligible for Medicaid or Medicaid expansion, so therefore they needed another resource to be able to get this help, or is that not part of the intake of it? When we used to have the programs, you know, a lot of the grants, we had a group of Alaskans who didn't have insurance, who didn't have a way to get these kind of services. But since then, we now have Medicaid expansion, so more people have access to care. So we're just trying to figure out these new programs we're having, are the targeted people, those who don't have their own insurance or Medicaid expansion, and therefore that's why we need these programs, because they have no way of getting this treatment without it. So we're trying to talk about the individual who's taking it.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, I think I completely missed your first question, so I apologize.
No problem.
A large part of these funds are really for start. They're really being used for startup funds for organizations that are interested in providing this service, and I don't believe that they are making a determination for who's eligible for that service, whether that person is a Medicaid beneficiary or not. But on that point, in order for them to be able to bill Medicaid for that service, they have to enroll as a Medicaid provider. And we can get you some information on whether or not those facilities are. The third grantee in this case was a grant to the TANNA Chiefs Conference in Fairbanks for $2.5 million, and they opened a sobering center in December of 2017, and they received assistance from the Mental Health Trust Authority for that facility as well. For the 2018 funds that are being requested in the governor's budget,
I think that was answered her question.
Okay. All right.
So, Representative Ortiz.
Mr. Chairman, just really quick.
Yes,
Representative. And if there's, you know, and maybe it's another conversation for another day, but we've never had the discussion on a lot of these grants since we've had Medicaid expansion to find out exactly who is the beneficiaries of these programs. And right now, that's one of the biggest drivers are the grants that are going out. So maybe they could just be put on the agenda at some other time, but I think it's a discussion we need to have.
Sure, and of course, facilities have to be in place, and Medicaid is providing services but not facilities. So I believe that these grants are to activate facilities that can then take recipients that, for whichever program funds the actual service, they can get reimbursed at that time, but there isn't reimbursement for construction of the facility.
Also keeping track of who's going where.
Right. So, Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Going back to line 98 in the topic of they have services, if you you explained how that was the goal to try to save, I think, $32 million, and you were able to save $35 million, commendable, obviously, in this fiscal environment. I can understand that. My question is, was the cuts to Dayhab services and your acknowledgement that that people won't be able to get the level of service that they've gotten in the past, was that part of that savings plan? Is that what that was?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, I'm sorry, I think I completely confused the issue. The $32 million in savings that was identified was actually through the tribal claiming policy that Governor Walker was able to negotiate with then Secretary of Health and Human Services, which is if you have an IHS beneficiary who's also a Medicaid beneficiary who receives their care through an IHS facility, that's 100% federal match. We do see some more opportunities in terms of the provision of long-term care services and supports, which include senior and disability services, by developing care coordination agreements between tribal and non-tribal organizations so that we can see some of those savings. But that was not a part of the DAHAB limitation of hours. Those are two separate issues. My apologies.
We'll have to get together separately on this.
Okay.
Because that's a very detailed question. So, those. I did want to put, we are really out of time. I wanted to put a couple of questions to you, and you can get back to me. First of all is on Hep C. Hepatitis C driving a lot of budget, or knowing we have a lot of hepatitis C, shall we say, patients or people that are infected with hepatitis C, and whether we are going to take care of that or not. And I want to find out how efficient and how effective the department is in utilizing the community health service portion of that, where there's that tremendous reduction in cost for providing Hep C vaccinations. And also, the other day, so that's one question. The second one is, the Mental Health Trust was here yesterday, and or the day before, can't even remember, keep the dates straight anymore. But they've had a revision in the policy or interpretation of what they can do. They are no longer avoiding prevention programs if those are looking at preventing them from acquiring new beneficiaries. There has to be a pretty good relationship in that. But the question is the department, public health, able to work on prevention of having people do the same thing? In other words, developing mental health problems, or are we still on the treatment of people that have developed mental health problems, and is that our sole function instead of actual prevention programs. And we're out of time, so it's a complicated issue, but I want to get back with you and the department and find out how we can avoid those avoidable healthcare issues and therefore limit costs in the future. And Representative Kawasaki had a question, at least to put on the table.
Just to put on the table, Mr. Chairman. Thanks. Back on the DAHAB, I think the overarching math was that it was 800 hours divided over 52 weeks, and then it went down to 600 hours divided by 52 weeks, which resulted in a 15-hour versus 12-hour. And I appreciate the process in being able to appeal that too, which some people have done. Can you just make sure to get the numbers on how many people are still in DAHAB? Did people quit DAHAB? Is it the same numbers or the numbers increasing? Just to kind of get a feel for where that program's going and whether there's more money available or maybe you can increase the hours at a certain point in time. Thanks.
Through the chair, Representative Kawasaki, we can provide all of that information.
Thank you. And if you would, getting back to us, use house.finance.legislation@akaleg.gov, and that will distribute to us, and we'll get it to all committee members. We appreciate the personal communications as well with individual members. But if there's a generalized question that's asked, we'd like to follow up so that the entire committee gets that information. Thank you very much for the presentation. We really appreciated your being able to get it into close to the time. It's a big department,
Yeah. And
we do appreciate it. So thank you very much.
Boyana.
And we'll take just a brief at ease while we get ready for the next presentation. We'll come back to order, and now would Ledge Finance come up to the table, walk us through the operating budget, and what we have, I believe, is we're calling it CS0, which is technical corrections to the budget. And so would you go ahead and lead us through those?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm David Teal, Director of the Legislative Finance Division. And what we refer to as CS0, you will see as version D. We refer to it as CS0 because we don't even know what the bill number, let alone the version number, is going to be as we go through the planning process. So you may hear it referenced that way, but in normal references its version D of HB 286 that's in front of you. And with a few exceptions, that version of the bill uses the same fund sources in the same amounts, in the same places, for the same purposes as the governor's bill. So from a budget transaction perspective, it's the same as the governor's bill. Go ahead.
I'm going to interrupt you for a minute just so the people online know what we're doing. I didn't go through that explanation. So we're going to introduce and hold the governor's operating budget, HB 286, and the mental health budget, 285. And just like last year, I'm proposing the committee substitute with just technical corrections for each budget bill. So we'll start with a clean version of the budget bill. And so Co-Chair Foster, may I have a motion?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I move that the committee adopt as its work draft CS for House Bill 286 Finance, which is 30-GH2564-D for Delta. That's Bruce and Wallace, January 23, 2018.
And I'll object for the purpose of explanation, and so we'll continue with the explanation with David Teal from Legislative Finance.
I jumped the gun. So the I said with a few exceptions. Those exceptions are really pretty minor. They are contingency language, and the difference between us and the governor is that we count contingencies as the maximum that the contingency can be. OMB counts it as the minimum. So that's it. So our budget report is slightly higher than the governor's. But the point is the bill is supposed to be the same for all practical purposes. It is the same, and the point of creating version D instead of using the governor's bill itself is for the ease of legislative legal and legislative finance, because as we move through the process, we now have a bill that's ready to amend without dealing with the format changes, the section references, the section locations, and technical and conforming language. Those are the things that are accomplished in what we call CS0 or version D of the governor's bill. Now, you do have a two-page document in front of you summarizing the changes from the governor's bill to version D. As noted at the bottom of page 2, the document doesn't list every change, and I don't intend to read this bill because you, or the document, because you have a document compare in front of you as well. That should start on page 98. I believe you have that in front of you. Okay, and that document compare will show you every change that's in the bill, right down to changing this to a the. So you can review that and confirm that version D is simply the governor's bill put into a legal services form. Numbers are the same. It's slightly different arrangement of the bill, but it is the same as the governor's bill.
Are there any questions? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Teal, the one question I wanted to make sure that I asked is related to the removing of the contingency language for 3/4 from CBR. What is, if that, why was that removed?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, it's duplicative. It already says in the CBR section that this occurs under constitutional language, which requires a supermajority. So you don't need a contingency saying it only applies if you get a supermajority vote. It's already done.
Thank you. One more follow-up.
Representative Pruitt.
And then as it relates to specifically, and I just had it, and of course I just shut it. There we go. As it, there's under in the section as it related to the school funding, I'm just curious why the semantics and originally in there was for the and I'm looking on your briefing page that you have with the red lines on it. I don't know if that'll help. It's page 116. So that would be under number 15 and 16 changes on your little sheet that you gave us here. But you struck for the fiscal year ending July 30th, 2019, from the basically BSA funding. Why was that struck?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, for both deposits, the K-12 foundation formula and transportation costs, the deposit to the fund can be used in multiple years. It's a fund cap, and you don't want to limit that to a specific year. So that removes the language for the fiscal year 19, because we don't want to limit any money that's in the school fund to being used in 19. That occurs a couple times, and yeah, I think that answers your question.
I think it does. One more follow-up.
A follow-up, Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, that does understand. And so I just don't want to assume, but in terms of F in that same on that same section, which is referring to the power cost equalization, where you struck for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2018. I don't want to assume. That's what I want to ask, but is that for the same reason?
Through the chair, exactly the same reason. And you may notice that for a fund capitalization, we remove that the money went in for a specific year because it is not for a specific year. At the same time, note in Section J, for instance, that taking the money out, it's necessary to fund, and then we're adding it's for pupil trans for the specific year, FY19. So this is just, I guess, legal services would say it's technical and conforming language. I think you can see that it accomplishes the same thing, but it does it in a way that doesn't limit the money. That was never the intent. The dates have gone back to the more normal format that's been used, and I don't know why the governor's office would have put those dates on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Clear on.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if we were to pass Representative Seaton's bill on funding education before this budget gets done, then I would assume, since we're not forward funding education, we're funding education for this year in a different appropriation bill, then those sections would come out of here.
Through the chair, I'm assuming it would, but I...
Well, I just want to make sure, because I know people have talked about it being forward funding, but that bill is not forward funding. It is to fund this year's education and transportation early, so that we don't have to worry about the pink slips, and therefore you would not also find it here. So if you could just verify that, Representative Seaton, so everybody knows, that would be awesome.
Yes, clarifying this year meaning FY19.
Yeah.
It's...
And FY19, right.
that's the full intent, is to have that early funded so that schools know it, but it's not changing any funding dates.
And then it would be removed out of this bill if that were to pass both sides,
right,
before this became through both bodies. Thank you.
I mean, that's my intention, because I think that's what we're doing, Representative Wilson. If legislative finance tells us that for some reason we need some reference to that in this, I don't think so. If we pass and the governor signs that other appropriation, I think that's done. But if legislative finance for some reason says there's some technical reason why we have to do something that is not doubly appropriating the money, because we wouldn't do that, I just want to make that clarification that I'm not quite familiar with how that is going to go down, but in no case would we be doubly appropriating the money.
And Mr. Chairman, again, we don't know what's going to pass, and the purpose of this bill was to mirror the governor's bill. The governor's bill has the general funding for schools in it, and if and when a bill passes funding it from the CBR, I'm assuming there would be an amendment along the way removing the general fund deposits.
Thank you.
Are there further questions on the or clarifications on any of the I call them changes, technical changes in the bill? Seeing none, I'll remove my objection to the adoption of version D, 2A6 as our working document. Is there any further objection? Seeing none, then 2A6 has been, version D has been adopted as our working document. And now we will move to the mental health budget. Co-chair Foster.
Sure, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move that the committee adopt as its work draft CS for House Bill 285 Finance. That's 30-GH2566/J4Juliet. That's Bruce and Wallace, January 23, 2018.
And I'll object for a purpose of explanation. And Mr. Teal, would you go ahead and explain the technical corrections incorporated in the work draft for the mental health budget bill, HB 285?
Mr. Chairman, the explanation is identical in purpose and in the reason for the types of changes that were made, with one exception here, and that's that you may note that there's language in the mental health bill that legislative finance has in there. It refers to the ability of the department to move money across appropriation lines. We would like that not to print, but our IT staff is still working on getting it to print. It prints in the operating bill. It shouldn't print in the mental health bill. It did. We couldn't get it out in time, so it's going to have to come out with an amendment because we're not certain that if you have an appropriate language in one bill that says you can move $25 million, and then you have the same language in a different appropriation bill, can you now move $50 million? So it may be that it isn't a problem, but one way or the other, it is not the same as the governor's bill, but we didn't want to do that. We just couldn't stop it.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Teal? Representative Pruitt.
Yeah, just real quick on that, do you have an idea of when you might be able to fix that challenge?
Through the chair, the only way to fix it at this point is with an amendment, because it is in version J and has to be amended out, and the technical fix is not, I don't think there's going to be a problem with the next version of the bill. It was just didn't have time to do it for this version.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was going to be if this was something that could be fixed by, you know, sometime next week, if we just held off on adopting this one, give us a chance for that clean one. But it sounds like we should go forward. We'll just remember to make sure we have an amendment for that. Thank you.
That is the full intent. Are there further questions on the mental health budget? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there any further objection to adopting this as our work draft? Seeing no objection, version J has been adopted of HB 285 as the committee's work draft. And is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing nothing, our next meeting is Monday, January 29th at 1:30 p.m. We will have presentation by the University of Alaska, the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, and the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And seeing no other questions, we'll gavel out at 3:32.